Hello and welcome back to the Cutline Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Santo. Today we're going to be talking with Shane Ryan. Shane is a writer for Golf Digest. He's been covering the PGA Tour for several years. He wrote a book a few years back called Slaying the Tiger, one of my favorite books. It was definitely some motivation for me about getting into the media world for sure. Shane has a new book coming out about the Ryder Cup that'll be out middle of next year. We talked about all that went down at Whistling Straits, the history of the Ryder Cup, and much more. You guys are going to really like this interview. So without further ado, Shane Ryan. Episode 3 of the Cutline Podcast. Shane, how are you?
Peter, I'm good, man. It's very nice to join you here.
So you just came off a big stretch, 5 majors, Ryder Cup. Now this fall, portion of the PGA Tour schedule that never stops. What sticks with you from the super season, as we called it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think in all, like you said, I was on there for 5 weeks at a time at the end, and the Ryder, leading up to the Ryder Cup, the stretch was really, but you know, before that, I was at a couple tournaments, but nothing too crazy. And even that, I ended up feeling like, man, what a long, what a long haul. And yeah, like looking forward to just having a little time at home now. But yeah, so I can only imagine what the players feel. These guys who have been, you know, the super season, it's almost like they never had an off season because of what was going on with COVID. And, you know, some of these guys have probably played like 45, 50 tournaments in the last 2 years. You know, your Sung Jae Im types who never take a week off. They're all tired. No matter how much they've played, they're all tired. For some guys, you know, they played the Ryder Cup too, so there's an added thing. Most of the good players are playing at least one fall event, two, if not two. Sea Island was the end of it, and I think people need to reset and, you know, come back and have a little rest and sort of take a breath, which hasn't been available to a lot of us, it feels like, over the COVID disaster.
So I keep going back. I don't remember what year Slaying the Tiger came out, but I was in high school, and I remember absolutely devouring that book, and I was like, okay, this is what I want to do with my life. That sounds super cool. How did that idea sort of come about, and what was sort of the process like of creating that?
Well, the idea was that I wanted to motivate high schoolers. No, that's really nice of you to say. Yeah, you know, so it's kind of funny how it all happened. It ends up sounding almost accidental when I tell the story, but I guess that's how a lot of things go in life. So I, like you, was a young person who wanted to be a sports writer, or at least I came to it a little bit later than you. I lived in New York trying to write novels and short stories after college. I did write novels and short stories after college. They just weren't good, which is, you know, publishers these days demand that the content be good and that people like it. So that was always an obstacle. I worked for 4 or 5 years at a cancer center called Memorial Sloan Kettering, not at the hospital, but at their like downtown boring office in the medical records division. And I was glorified secretary, or not even glorified, you know, just, it was a fine job, but it was boring. Lived in New York City. And then at some point decided I need to get into journalism because that's the only way I can see getting paid for writing at this point. And it's kind of a funny thing to realize when you're 26 or 27, because it's like, you know, most people at that point would go to law school or do something lucrative. And I was like, yes, journalism. That's the way to do it. So long story short, I went to UNC Journalism School for a year and got insanely lucky to get a job at Grantland, the Bill Simmons' original ESPN company. And that was just based on a blog. I was writing a Duke basketball blog, and a post happened to go viral. The post was about the state of the media. John Feinstein got a hold of it. Chris Jones, the Esquire writer who became a Grantland writer. And then Bill Simmons got a hold of it, reached out to me. We started a communication. That summer, after my first year, I was interning in Charlotte. They were starting Grantland. I reached back out to him. He gave me a tryout, more or less a tryout, saying, we need this morning recap post and then one other blog a day. But basically, put your own spin on it. Show us what you got. That became a feature called About Last Night. But anyway, I tried out with 3 or 4 other people, and I was lucky enough to get the job. And that's how it started with Grantland. And then in 2012 with Grantland, I begged him to send me to the Ryder Cup. And I was never a big golfer growing up. I liked the majors, but I didn't golf at all. And I wasn't somebody you'd call a big fan or anything like that. But I always loved the Ryder Cup. I always thought there was something really special about it. And nobody else at Grantland was into golf. So, you know, they kind of were like, hey, Shane grinds every day in the morning writing these posts. So fine, we'll give him a little bone. You know, we'll throw him a bone. He can go to the Ryder Cup. wrote about the 2012 Ryder Cup. Of course, that was Medina with the incredible European comeback on Sunday. And the story I wrote was called, I think it was called Poulter's Cup. I think it was pretty good. And Bill Simmons really liked it. And he was like, all right, we'll send you to a couple golf tournaments next year. And I went, next year I went to a couple majors, and I went to the match play when it was in Arizona. And then after that, a literary agent reached out to me and said, hey, you're this young golfer, which is kind of funny for me to hear because, you know, a golfer, I've been to like four tournaments. And he said, why don't we do a book about the young players on the PGA Tour, the up-and-coming players. You'll be on tour for a year. It'd be great. And that sounded awesome to me. I'd always dreamed of it. His name was Bird Lavelle, and he's still my agent, and he's wonderful. And I may be mispronouncing his last name. I hope I'm not. But anyway, he's a terrific agent, and yeah, he made my dream happen. You know, we wrote up this proposal, sold it, and all of a sudden, we had a book deal, and 2014 comes, and I'm on the PGA Tour for, you know, something insane, like 30 weeks or something like that. And that's how Slaying the Tiger came about.
You obviously interviewed so many people, I'm sure. Are there one or two that stand out?
From that original process? Yeah, there are a couple that stand out. Interviewed most of the big names, at least for like 10 minutes. The ones I didn't are like, I think just Rory. Rory McIlroy was impossible to interview. He still is for me. I still haven't gotten Rory. I've talked to him in person before, even one-on-one a little bit. But in terms of getting a sit-down, like hour-long interview, which would be so cool, that hasn't happened. But yeah, Spieth, Ricky Fowler, Jason Day. Jason Day was, he's just such a wild story coming from a very, very poor family in Australia. It's just got to be, I mean, it is so rare, even there. I mean, almost impossible in America, but even there, very rare for someone like him from such a hard scrabble beginning to become, you know, a major winner and one of the best professional golfers in the world. So his story was great. He's also great because he likes telling his story and the story changes. The details change. He's one of those guys, it's kind of like there's a myth about him, but there's a very, you know, hard bedrock of truth about the myth. So talking with him was great. You know, Matt Every, I'll always remember talking to Matt Every because he was so unfiltered. Now he's going to be on the Golf Channel. That'll be really interesting to see how he does there. Yeah, so guys like that were good. Ricky Fowler ended up being really fun to talk to. You know, and some guys weren't fun to talk to, but, you know, it's for the most part, yeah, I mean, look, it was a grind writing that book, but when you actually got to talk to the players, that was a really, really good part of it.
How did you feel having Tiger make his huge comeback after writing this book? Not assuming he's done, but kind of assuming he's done.
Yeah, well, I always try to correct the record just a little here, which is that the idea of the book, the idea of Slaying the Tiger was the metaphor, not just for like these young players who are going to start taking over the game, because look, even if Tiger came back, there's a limit to that, right? At some point, he is going to be 45 years old and it'll be all she wrote. So when that happens, kind of what I was getting at is how do you fill the vacuum left by Tiger Woods, who is such a huge part of golf for so long and a huge part of why all of us make money, right? Why the golf ecosystem can sustain itself. What do you do when that's gone? And this was sort of about how, in my opinion, it was going to be Tiger by committee, where you're not going to have one Tiger, forget it. Like that's just a historical figure that you're not going to duplicate. Maybe ever, certainly probably not in our lifetimes, or if it is, it'll be, you know, very unique. But you can have the interest that Tiger spawns, and then you can have a bunch of people who are interesting, and it becomes, and this is exactly what's happened, where, you know, golf has maintained its popularity because you have a number of interesting young personalities who can kind of share the spotlight a little more, or attention shifts from one to the other. And yeah, so that was what the book is about. Later I did write a stupid article saying Tiger was done, and I was rightly skewered for that when he won the Masters. But the book itself was not pronouncing him dead. It was more like answering the question of what happens in life after Tiger.
We'll transition to your second book coming out May, I think.
Yeah, coming out in May. Yep.
What made you want to go through this whole process again?
Same reason like women have children again, even though they like evolution means you forget the pain and the suffering and everything like that, because to birth your child, in my case, a book, you sort of forget all what went into it. And you just remember, oh yeah, I had a book. That was nice. And yeah, as someone with two kids, I can confirm that it's like, oh, you want another kid? Do you remember what happened last time? So anyway, no, yeah. I mean, I always loved the Ryder Cup, and you know, there was an opportunity there to write a book about it, and I'd always dreamed of that. And so I took it, you know, I seized it, I guess. It was, in some cases, again, a little bit arduous, but not the same as the first one. I wasn't out for 30 weeks this time. I didn't need to be. So there was that too, where I said, it's not going to be the same, like, unbelievable grind. But yeah, it was just, you know, it was there, and I've always wanted to do it. And so I did it. I've told you, like, and I've told other people, I had to write this book in about 40 days after the Ryder Cup was over. And that's not something I recommend. I never will do that again. But I think the product is really good. So yeah, that's story's a lot more basic than the first one, but that's how it came about.
What stood out, obviously, you had to do a deep dive into the history. And I know your podcast was fantastic. Loved it. What stood out in that extensive research?
Well, thank you again. I think my overall takeaway or whatever from all this is I was always interested by the Ryder Cup and the tactics that went into it and the interesting dynamic where Europe kept beating the US, even though, you know, the US has better players. And the more I researched it, the more interesting it became. The history became very interesting. Understanding the strategies on a deeper level made it more interesting. Learning more about the personalities of the players, and, you know, the current ones, but also guys like Tony Jacklin and Seve Ballesteros and Jack Nicklaus and, you know, Curtis Strain, all these characters, Paul Azinger especially, that made it all more interesting. And it's this rich, like, the book is like it's a story of the modern Ryder Cup. It's a story of Whistling Straits, but it's also a story of the last 40 years of Ryder Cup history. You know, the 40 years since it got good. And yeah, I just, you know, I love that aspect. I love history, and I love that. I didn't think I realized quite how rich the Ryder Cup history was, and it really is a rich history.
What was it like being there this year? I know it was a weird year with COVID and maybe the European fans not traveling as well as they normally would. You've been to ones in the past. How different was it?
You know, it was, yeah, you're right. The two American ones I've been at in the past, Medina and Hazeltine, you know, one was ended up being a European victory. The other was a pretty lopsided American victory. In both cases, there were these pockets of European fans. And anybody who knows anything about European fans knows they're very, very good at being loud, even if they're in small numbers. They sing, they chant, they do a lot of things American fans don't do just because culturally that's what they do. And they've always done. And so they can make themselves felt. And I saw this on Sunday at Medina. They can make themselves felt really quickly and really loudly, even if you only have 10%, even if they're only 10% of the big crowd, they can sound like much more, especially around Americans. Now, that was gone in Whistling Straits. And that, you know, to hear the Europeans tell it was a big deal not to have them. You look at the final score, 19-9, and you say, I don't think fans were going to make a difference there. You know, I don't think that was going to do it. But they did. You know, that was for them. Padraig Harrington thought there'd be more there. He thought there'd be, you know, Europeans across America coming and Irish and English across America to come watch this Ryder Cup. And there really weren't. There were, you know, again, really small pockets. I'm talking like a dozen people, maybe a dozen Irish people watching Shane Lowry, but they're just getting dwarfed by the huge American crowds. So yeah, that was an element that made it a little bit different. Other than that, you know, every Ryder Cup is different. They all take on these identities that you just can't expect, and it's a matter of the course, and it's a matter of the captains and the players. And this one was, you know, the story of this one from the beginning was just what a solid job Steve Stricker had done and how much America has learned at last from the losses that Europe has dealt them. And yeah, I mean, Europe wasn't ready, but I don't know if they could have been ready. You know, there was too much waiting for them. I don't think Padraig Harrington was a great captain. I don't think he was a terrible captain, but you needed to be great and then some and lucky to win this one, and just being mediocre was not going to kind of cut the mustard.
Is there a story that stands out to you from being there that we didn't get to see on TV watching?
I think one good one, there's this mystery throughout the week of Tiger Woods was texting the team and everybody wanted to know what it said, and nobody was telling on the American side. It's come out since that it was about stepping on their necks or something like that. And I thought one moment that was interesting, and I actually didn't see this moment. It was relayed to me, but Patrick Cantlay coming off one of the Saturday matches, and he was at the turn, and you know they were winning, and they had just won a couple holes. It was him and Xander. I guess it must have been Saturday afternoon. No, it must have been Saturday morning because they didn't play Saturday afternoon. So their Saturday morning match, foursomes, they just won a couple holes, and Patrick Cantlay, who had just had this unbelievable duel with Bryson DeChambeau, kind of coming into his own. He had just won the FedEx Cup. He came off and he said, it's time to step on their fucking necks. And it's just like you have these young Americans that are so unbelievably intense and care so much about the Ryder Cup. Wasn't always the case with American teams. You know, I spoke with Davis Love, who, you know, born in the 60s, came of age at a time when the Ryder Cup was not a competitive event. He came of age in a time when Americans were dominating and nobody cared about it. And he told me, quite frankly, when he was 20 years old, making an American Ryder Cup team was not even on his radar. It wasn't even a goal. It just didn't matter. Whereas these guys, you know, the Cantleys, the Schauffeles, Spieth, Justin Thomas, Scotty Scheffler, all those guys grew up watching Europe basically kick America's butt, and now they have a chip on their shoulder. So that was one moment that I thought was kind of illustrative of how things have changed.
Where do you think this kind of leaves us now going forward? Did anybody's legacy change or expectations going forward?
I don't think anybody's legacy changed. You know, Steve Stricker is now a winning Ryder Cup captain and Padraig Harrington is a losing Ryder Cup captain. And that's a bigger deal for Stricker because Stricker has never won a major. And he said, this is the highlight of my career. This was my major. Padraig Harrington was a major winner. I can't remember if he ever got to number one in the world, but if he didn't, he got awfully close. And so he's going to be able to absorb the loss better than Stricker would have. Yeah, so Harrington never got to number one, but he's close. Harrington will be able to absorb the loss better. Now, he didn't absorb it that well. I mean, it really hurt him, and he wants to defend his legacy, and it pains him that he's a losing Ryder Cup captain. So those two guys, you can say, okay, maybe their legacies adjust a little bit. You know, Stricker, I think his legacy is secure. That was a big win for him. Harrington, this will be okay. I can't remember the other part of your question, but no, none of the players' legacies have changed or anything like that. Bo, yeah, expectations going forward, I think, you know, the U.S. has a very good reason to believe that they have a chance to win on foreign soil for the first time in 30 years when they go to Rome. And it's going to take a lot. It's, you know, when you say they haven't done it in 30 years, that's a good indication. It's pretty darn hard to do this. But I think, you know, you look at what just happened, you go, they got a chance. They need a good captain and they need good players. And they, you know, all the Europeans love to say a lot can happen in 2 years. Yeah, it can. But a lot of their players are going to get even older than they already are. And the American players are entering their primes. And so that's what I think going forward, you look at for America to truly plant their flag as the ascendant Ryder Cup power. They have to do what they did at Whistling Straits. Now they have to win on the road. And I think they can. And I think they probably should.
It felt to me like there were a lot of European players, Poulter, Westwood, come to mind, that they sort of acknowledged this might be it for me in this event. And it doesn't seem like Europe has that many guys behind them, really, up and coming. The U.S., there's just, you could go pick 50 guys who could really do well. And is there anyone from Europe that could ascend?
Well, I mean, yeah, you're making a really good point, which is that, yeah, I mean, Wade Westwood's not going to play again, right? There's no way. He probably will be captain. Maybe, I shouldn't say probably. He may be captain in Rome. Poulter's getting older. If he plays again, I'd be mildly surprised. Sergio's getting older. All these guys. I mean, how many guys do they have over 40? I'm looking at the list now. You know, 1, 2, 3 with the three I just mentioned, and then Paul Casey, who's 44. And then their other guys aren't exactly young. You know, I mean, they have Rahm and Rory and Matt Fitzpatrick, and that was about it. For young guys, Tyrrell Hatton, I guess. And even Rory, you know, is in his 30s. So, yeah, the question is, who's going to come up next? And you hear all these names from the Europeans, guys you have never heard of. And sure, in 2 years, they could all be great. That's definitely possible. It does seem very optimistic on their end. And so you're like, oh, yeah, Giovanni, whatever, or like Joachim Hogard or whatever. I'm getting the names wrong. But the point is, like, you don't know these guys. They're not world forces yet. And the Europeans seem like they're pinning their hopes on them being world forces by the time Rome comes around. Whereas, just like you said, the U.S., they're already world forces, a lot of these guys, all of them pretty much. And you can easily point to 10 more below them and say, yeah, they could be there in 2 years. And so that's why I'm saying the foundation for the U.S. team is great. The foundation for the European team is rickety. So, you know, home course advantage, they're going to really need to lean on it hard in Rome if they have a prayer of, you know, stopping a complete disaster.
I know we sort of thought this shift was maybe starting to happen after Hazeltine, but do you think it has shifted now? This is going to be different going forward.
It's so difficult to tell because you're right. You know, the difference in Hazeltine, I would say, is you had it was kind of a weird Ryder Cup team for the U.S. You had some of your usual suspects, but you also had like Ryan Moore. It wasn't filled with guys where you're like, oh, they could play, you know, they could play 10 years of Ryder Cups from now. You had like, you know, Phil was on the team and Jimmy Walker and Brant Snedeker, Zach Johnson, JB Holmes, Kuchar. Like that was an old team, you know, that really you weren't looking at that team going, oh, these guys, this is a power dynasty that's going to last for, you know, until 2040. Well, you look at this current American team and you do see that and they proved how tough they were. So that's a big difference between this and Hazeltine. Other thing is that in Paris, there was a lot of bad luck happening for the Americans. You know, full credit to the Europeans for winning. But Jim Furyk happened to sort of be compelled to pick certain captain's picks that were always going to be bad for the Golf National. Mickelson, DeChambeau, Tiger had just finished winning the Tour Championship, but he was insanely tired. He came and didn't play well. Patrick Reed played awfully for a guy who, you know, you at that time, you looked at him as, you know, your Captain America or whatever. None of them had seen the course before. Now, some of those things will be true in Rome. It's going to be harder for them to get people to go play ahead of time in Rome. That's going to be very difficult. So you got little things like that that are going to benefit the Europeans and are always going to benefit the home team. However, yeah, they know, they learned a lot from Paris. They learned their mistakes. They are going to have a better idea of how to play a course that's narrow with thick rough. And they're going to do everything they can. There's this concept, Peter, called institutional memory. And what that basically boils down to in the Ryder Cup is you're learning from your past. You're learning from successes and you're learning from failures. The U.S. didn't have that for a long time, and Europe has had it since the 80s. The U.S. has it now. And so they're not going to go into Rome befuddled like they did in Paris, is my opinion.
Are there any players coming off this really U.S. route? Which players did your opinion really change on? Did anything sort of get altered on either side?
I think Rory will look back on his first 2 days of play. And, you know, you can tell by the way he cried on Sunday. He's going to be disappointed in himself and how he sort of led his team, because they needed him and Jon Rahm to be miracle workers. And Jon Rahm was a miracle worker. Jon Rahm was fantastic. And, you know, Ian Poulter played very, very well with Rory. And Rory just, there was nothing there for him. Rory didn't give him anything. My opinion doesn't change him, but I think he will look back on this as a sort of distinct failure on his part. And he probably should, not to sound too harsh, but you know, that's, they badly needed Rory McIlroy and they didn't get him. So there's that. On the American side, I mean, my opinion of everyone is just pretty rock solid. One guy I'll point to is Scottie Scheffler, where he was magnificent in the role he played. His job was to come in. He was the lowest ranked player on the team. He was the captain's pick, that the only one we were maybe not sure of, like maybe it could have been Kevin Na or Webb Simpson or whatever. He got basically what you consider the last pick. Job was to come in and play with Bryson, which he did beautifully. They got a point and a half out of two matches. And then it just so happened to draw Jon Rahm, the hero, the European hero, on Sunday. Rahm was tired. You know, he led his team in all four sessions. Scottie Scheffler was fresh, which is exactly what Steve Stricker had in mind, by the way. And, you know, he kicked Rahm's butt and he planted that flag for America. And that was the kind of thing where, you know, everybody said it. That morning, when you see Jon Rahm go four down after five holes or whatever it was, it's massive. I mean, it just tells everyone you're not going to come back. It's over. You know what I mean? On both teams, it's over. U.S. got the bit between their teeth by seeing that and could just go out and dominate with, you know, no nerves. And Europe, I mean, it's just deflating to see that this guy who, I mean, Rahm was simply spectacular. And, you know, if he's not going to win, we're definitely not going to win as a team. We're screwed. And so that was huge. So Scheffler, I thought, was, you know, incredibly impressive as a guy who's never won a tournament, you know, is really good.
We'll segue a bit. We've heard a lot, and some actual news has actually come out recently with Greg Norman leading this other tour, challengers to the PGA Tour, potential huge shakeup in the landscape of professional golf. I feel like it's, so far, it's kind of been a lot of smoke and mirrors, but stuff does seem to actually be happening. Now, where do you see this going?
You know, I don't know. It's, my inclination is to say this is stupid and terrible and it should die on the vine, and I hope it would. And I believe that. It seems to me like you said, we keep hearing about it. It's a thing that won't die. It's like the zombie tour. And yet they haven't really got a foothold quite yet. Maybe they have a few guys that are expressing interest and things like that. I think the PGA Tour is, they're going to come out guns blazing. They know this is something that they need. You know, you always, if you're a corporation like that, you need to take your competition, any emerging rival, you need to take it seriously. I think any player who does it is a traitor. Like, I'm really disappointed in any player who joins that. I don't care if you're the best player in the world or whatever. You know, it's not just about taking Saudi money. It's about burning the bridge to career golf success that in many cases you took. Billy Horschel made a comment about, you know, we need fewer people in PGA Tour fields. And I don't think he's a supporter of the, maybe he is, I don't know. But it's like Billy Horschel finished outside the top 125, but maintained his tour card for many years. And you go, do you forget so easily, you know, what it takes to get there? And, you know, let's say in the fantasy world where the 20 best players defect and go play on the Saudi Golf Tour, PGA Tour is basically dead. You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing. It's like, you're not going to attract as much, I shouldn't say dead, but you're not going to attract as much money by any, not even close, if you don't have the top 20 players in the world and you're running an American tour and stuff like that, you're going to lose sponsors. It's just not going to be sustainable. And as it is now, not only is it sustainable, they make money, but they support, you know, a golf career for hundreds of people, you know, not just on the PGA Tour, on all these other mini tours and stuff. But those 20 players make that happen. But they got there because of it too. And so I don't like when people get somewhere and then burn the bridge after them. I think it's selfish. And I think it's, you know, it really speaks poorly of the people who are thinking about doing it. And I hope history judges them accordingly.
It seems like we're going to see changes as a result of this. We don't really know what they are yet. Are there some that you would say, yeah, this is probably a good idea that they should do? And is there anything being thrown around that you're just like, no way?
Yeah, the PGA Tour is doing a carrot and stick thing because nobody likes to be told they can't do something or to be bullied into it, right? So you can't just say, yeah, go ahead, play on the Saudi Tour. You'll never play on the PGA Tour again. You're banned. You kind of hint at that. You have a little menace, you know, there's like a little threat. But then you say, oh, by the way, we're doing the Player Impact Program, or we're doing, what's the new one? There's some new one that just came out that they may, like some kind of series they were proposing. It's basically like a way to try to cut off the World Golf Tour at the knees. And so they have to do that, or they feel like they have to anyway. And I think that's smart because you're not like, you don't want to just play hardball because that's taking a really big risk. You want to play hardball and you want to offer them, you know, the sweet side as well. So yeah, they're taking their steps and, you know, we'll have to judge this stuff as it happens. It's really hard to say right now whether it's going to be good or bad for the game or enjoyable or a good entertainment product or whatever, but I see what they're doing and I see why they're doing it.
Do you think that, I guess, why would somebody say as big as Greg Norman take this on? Like, why does he feel the need to go against the PGA Tour like this?
That is a really great question. And I don't know why Greg Norman does that. Maybe he's, you know, maybe it's about the money. That man can't possibly need more money. Why do you get in bed with those people and go to war, right? Why are you doing it? That's a really good question. And I would love to know the answer. I don't know the answer. Maybe he's got a vendetta against the PGA Tour. Maybe he just like is a businessman who considers this a great opportunity and none of the other stuff bothers him. I don't know. You know, I mean, to get inside Greg Norman's head would be really to unlock the key to this whole thing. And someday somebody will. But it's baffling. It's a baffling kind of move for him. I think talk about legacies, like not that he had a great legacy anyway. You think of Greg Norman, you think of all the times he gagged in major tournaments, but he was a major winner. People, you know, respected the dignity with which he handled his losses. And now you look at him and go, well, this guy's just a jerk.
We just had this whole fall season on the PGA Tour that kind of feels like nothing really happened. Rory won an event and I feel like I don't even remember it. Do you think there's some sort of change there that could make it more enticing either for the players or the fans or both?
Here's the thing with fall golf. It's what I was with Brandon Porath the other day on his podcast. And it's like, it's bonus, you know, and that's what we should see it as bonus. Like there's a lot of golf throughout the year. You're always going to have your majors be paramount. You're always going to have your Ryder Cup be paramount. You know, people seem to be getting more and more into the FedEx Cup playoffs. And then you have this fall season, right? Where it's on during football. You've got a million things competing with it. This past Sunday was a good example. You had the race to Dubai. You had Rory versus Morikawa, which is super compelling. You had the LPGA's Tour Championship. And that's just in golf, right? You don't get into the football and all the other things that were on TV that, you know, consumers have a choice to watch. So I don't agonize over how entertaining people find fall golf. To me, you can sustain it. You can support it. You can give out these big purses. A guy like Taylor Gooch, who won at Sea Island yesterday, his life changes. It's a big deal for him. Again, it broadens the ecosystem of professional golf. And I think that's good. And I think it's like, even if for me, like if I'm not covering it, even if fall golf, the most is like, oh yeah, I'll watch the last hour of the CJ Cup to see if Rory wins. Even if that's all it is, you know, where, you know, in a summer tournament, maybe I'm watching all day Sunday, even if it's just like an hour here or there, or if it provides a few compelling finishes, you know, Hideki Matsuyama wins in Japan, whatever the case may be, that's good enough for me. I think that's good enough. And I think as long as the PGA Tour can sustain it, I don't need it to be the Masters. It's never going to be. I don't need it to be that. So yeah, I have a sort of contentment about fall golf.
Last question, and we'll get you out of here. I know you got to run. It feels like the Ryder Cup has sort of, it feels like it grew with this U.S. win. Now that the tide seems to be turning, it feels like, man, this thing really matters. Really probably up there with the major championships, if not more. But then we have the President's Cup that's just like the little brother that, I mean, Tiger being captain made it much more of a bigger deal, but Dale Hollow, really?
You know, it's, I was surprised to see Davis captain, you know, just because he's done it before. I thought it worked pretty well to have Steve Stricker captain a President's Cup team before, you know, doing the Ryder Cup. But yeah, the thing with the President's Cup is it's, people forget the Ryder Cup was a terrible product for 50 years. You know, US just blew at the time, the UK and then UK and Ireland, they blew them out every single time. And it's exactly what's happening in the President's Cup. Now, all of a sudden, last time you had a really competitive one, and that was really exciting in Royal Melbourne. But it's, you know, I love team match play golf. I hope it, I like the President's Cup. I can't help it. I really do. And I think one day, as the world gets better and better at golf, one day it's going to be a really good event, just like the Ryder Cup has turned into a really good event. So I just think, keep it going. You know what I mean? Like, just be patient. Even if we may be 50 by the time, or that's not that far off for me, unfortunately. We may be 60 by the time it's good, but that'll be worth it. If we're good when it's 60, to have two tournaments like that will be great.
I know some people, one idea I have heard thrown around, I think it's potentially a great idea, making the President's Cup a mixed event, men and women. I guess I'm kind of surprised we haven't had that yet in any event.
I think a mixed event would be awesome. I don't know if I'd want it for the President's Cup because I like the Solheim Cup a lot. And I think, so what do they have? They don't really have a President's Cup equivalent for women, right? They have maybe like some kind of like World Cup or something, or...
They tried that International Crown and it didn't, that's right, really, yeah. It didn't really work. It
didn't really work. Yeah, I mean, the President's, I mean, they should, right? Because if you look at international golf, it's way better on the women's side than it is on the men's side. Like, essentially, if you did that, you'd be like U.S. versus Korea, right? U.S. versus Korea and Japan. That would be fantastic, with a couple Aussies probably thrown in, maybe like one Canadian. That would be, I mean, the fact that they haven't done that is kind of crazy. Now that you kind of think about it, it's like, yeah, Solheim Cup is great, but Europe is not really a women's golf powerhouse in the same way that the U.S. is, in the same way that the Asian countries are. So that would be cool. I hope they do that. Yeah, but a mixed event, you're 100% right. And a mixed match play event would be like, oh, chef's kiss. Like, do it at the Zurich, you know? Like, make that your one. Yeah, I think it'd be cool.
All right. I know you got to run, so we'll get you out of here. But thank you. Thank you for the time. I appreciate it.
You got it, Peter. And anybody listening, Peter is an extremely good writer and an extremely intuitive, smart mind in the game of golf. So, gobble this man up. Hire him if you're looking for somebody.
I appreciate it.